My name is Michael McCusker. I suppose this upcoming weekend is to be considered the 4th of July weekend, holiday weekend, although Independence Day is next Wednesday. I remember a couple of years ago, in keeping with the spirit of three-day weekend holidays, when the 4th was celebrated on the 5th. It is somewhat ironically appropriate that this coming Monday, the 2nd of July, is celebrated this year as the 4th, because July 2nd, 1776, was the day the U.S. Congress voted to secede from England. James Madison said the 2nd of July would be commemorated as Independence Day for as long as the nation existed. Instead, of course, in this culture of persistent hucksterism, we celebrate not the act, but its press release, albeit the most famous press release in our history, the Declaration of Independence, which has, obviously, much more substance than most press releases that we are bombarded with. So I would like to read a couple of things that we might think about this weekend and the few days following until the 4th, and perhaps maybe beyond. And by the way, before I do start to read, I'm very pleased in the most part with the Supreme Court's acceptance of the health bill, the health law, especially the mandate. It's a step further towards maybe getting complete health care, which paying taxes, I think we all should get. We're going to pay the government money. We should have three things guaranteed at least: health and medical care, housing and sustenance, food. And then whatever's left, they can pay the banks for screwing up the society. But until then, we should at least get those basic three. Those should be the first priorities. So this is one of them that's coming up, although it's going to take a long time. But people have to get used to it. And fortunately, in this case, it was not a sympathetic court. It was actually a very hostile court that passed this. And that will probably help in the long run. Well, I'd like to read something. I'll start off with something I wrote. I call it an assumption of freedom. And I have to put the disclaimer that this is my opinion and my opinion only in the entire universe. And I'd like to dedicate this reading and this show to my childhood chum who came to see me for the first time in 30 years yesterday, Gary Charles Quigley. We were in grammar school and high school together. And he probably kept my tail from getting roundly kicked many times in our youth. So he's on the road back to California, and if he's got his radio tuned, I hope he enjoys this program. I'll start with a quote from Art Crumb. As Mark Twain once said about America, it is a civilization which has destroyed the repose of life, replaced its contentments, its poetry, its soft romantic dreams and visions with the money fever, sordid ideals, vulgar ambitions, and the sleep which does not refresh. And that was Art Crumb quoting Mark Twain. And Louis Brandeis, the great Supreme Court judge. We can have a democratic society, or we can have a concentration of great wealth in the hands of the few. We cannot have both. An assumption of freedom. July is a month celebrated as the birthday of the United States of America. In 2012, Yankee Doodle is 12 score plus 5. Actually, plus 6. And its founding principles of liberty and justice for all. The larger voices loudly proclaim the USA as the freest, most wonderful country on earth and unfurl the flags of worldly preeminence and godly jingoism. Smaller voices disagree. which is not to say the ideals of liberty and justice for all are not articulate in the nation, or that their intent is less than political and personal freedom, and something akin to equality under the law, however discriminatory its actual practice, for everybody now and in the future who live within its geospace. The persistent conundrum is that the actuality is far less than advertised, that neither freedom nor equality is the daily reality for millions of Americans who are governed instead as if they live in a police state because they are poor or are of a minority race, that the old evils of worth measured by wealth, gender, and race continually and perversely undercut the foundations the nation claims to stand upon and believe in. The oldest struggle after survival is for freedom, of being part of a community, not enslaved by it. The eternal, pitiless struggle between haves and have-nots. The despairing rage of those condemned to live bitterly wretched lives in the shadows and as menials to the economic and politically powerful few who are in their turn angrily terrified by this rage. History shrieks with the pain of injustice, only briefly muffled by excesses of gross brutality. Sometimes the oppressed overthrow the lords and bosses, but elites always rise in even the most originally classless societies. If the American Revolution is accepted as more than a revolt of colonial bourgeoisie, and that it gave birth to an entirely egalitarian society in which the common citizenry had a chance to be their own rulers, it should also be realized that every reform has been bitterly and often bloodily resisted and only adopted with great reluctance. Reforms that have been ratified are usually countered with vicious backlash and unrelenting reversion, which might be the case of this recent Supreme Court decision about medical care. Vernon Parrington believed that American history has, quote, been largely a struggle between the spirit of the Declaration of Independence and the spirit of the Constitution. The one primarily concerned with the rights of man, and that's part of the quote, the other more practically concerned with the rights of property, unquote. Parrington could not understand why intelligent Americans confused the two and thought of them as complementary. Their unlikeness is unmistakable, he wrote in Main Currents of American Thought. The one a classical statement of the French humanitarian democracy, the other an organic law designed to protect the minority under Republican rule. Historians have long debunked his ideological division of the nation's two most important documents. Yet, as early as the 1820s, Alexis de Tocqueville observed, as R.R. Palmer wrote, quote, that equality was one of the most fundamental ideas of the United States, but he also thought that the American Revolution had been of little importance in producing this spirit of equality. And that was R.R. Palmer quoting de Tocqueville. Or, as Nicholas Chamfort put it, society is composed of two large classes, those who have more dinners than appetite, and those who have more appetite than dinners. Those two classes form a single system, Henry Adams wrote, and that system is the price at which the proletarian is to be bought and sold, the bread and circuses. George Bernard Shaw, a government that robs Peter to pay Paul can always count on the support of Paul. The obsession for world power, which is America's self-proclaimed manifest destiny, has given it the myopic paradox of patriotic corruption. General Eisenhower said in his farewell speech as president in 1961, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies, in a final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed." Nationalism, a packaged product that disguises inequities and rot within a nation while simultaneously promoting the imperial ambitions of a powerful and avaricious minority, is a prerequisite for expansion, primarily economic colonialism in this new millennium. And ideologies, which are fictions, are yet justifications for tyrannies and terrorisms, large and small. The greater cost is the ultimate loss of liberties in the holy names of national defense and national security. Government hides its clandestine acts against foreign nations and its own citizens under official secrets classifications, which deny access to the citizenry. Operating away from public scrutiny and on behalf of the narrow interests of the elite few, the government cloaks its corruption with pieties of patriotism and the blessings of God. Our cultural pashas proselytize our obviously superior and enlightened supremacy to a wary and suspicious world, while subverting opposition at home to our post-Cold War mode of Pax Romania. War is the enemy of democracy, Howard Zinn said unequivocally. He might have added that militarism leads both to war and domestic subordination and is as much the nemesis of freedom. The assumption of freedom is that the average human being is intelligent and inspired by compassion, and that most people will think and act reasonably most of the time. The usual assumption of government is the common citizenry is unintelligent, primitive, and brutal, and must be shielded from its own perfidious nature. The tendency of government is to rule, and it is a parasite. Government must, by the implication or force of its sovereignty, feed upon and subtract the political liberties, rights, and powers of those it rules. It is the responsibility of the people to always contain the power of their government, which, without that restraint, will relentlessly take away power from the people. In the past century, the U.S. government has usurped much power for itself, some of it for the betterment of the people, such as civil rights laws and medical health laws, but also much of it against the people, such as the rule of terror, secrecy, and doubt that characterized the Cold War and nuclear arms race with the now defunct Soviet Union. The idea of the authority of law is a recognition by most of us that a few of us will cheat, rob, murder, and otherwise make life uncomfortable for the rest. A majority desires protection from the psychopathy of an avaricious minority. For exactly the same purpose, to protect us from predatory or cruel government, the political freedom and power of the common citizenry has been made the law of this nation. Yet a government of the people is assumed to also be a government for the people, so it is entrusted to act in the people's behalf, to prevent or correct the excesses of monopolistic and unprincipled private interests, which is in contrast to the current era of virulent capitalism. Former President Reagan was wrong when he said that a free government must be free from government. The dismantling of government protections, which has accelerated since his administration, alters government's role from acting as benefactor and protector of civil rights and liberties to its more ominous nature of guardian and enforcer of the reigning status quo, which is increasingly articulated by the wealthy elite and the religious right. Freedom implies a mature citizenry, while the nature of authority requires that no one grow up. To be free and remain that way is a large responsibility, and many people don't want it. Political freedom insists upon the value of the individual, but the accelerated complexity of American society is constructed on aggregates and consensus and makes the contributions and usefulness of each of us less valuable. Our thinking and sense of self-worth are critically affected. An individual and ultimately collective sense of personal and political helplessness settles in. Our freedoms seem to be only wishful lies, bedtime tales told by those we democratically select to Alka-Seltzer our minds of thought or responsibility. Reality is treated as event, which translates into what entertains. Almost everyone seems apprehensive of the period we are trying to live through, and of this new century we step warily into. Zestful prophecies of humanity uber alles are proclaimed as our apocalyptic visions. The law of parsimony is not helpful. The simplest answer is probably the wrong one. If God is dead, who is there but Homo Jones to believe in? The great 19th century idea that made the 20th century a maelstrom of hubris and horror. From top to bottom, the whole system is a fraud, Henry Adams wrote. All of us know it, laborers and capitalists alike, and all of us are consenting parties to it. He thought the entire society would go to rack if we really lay hands of reform on our rotten institutions. Forrest Amsden, former news director of KGW-TV in Portland, he died in 1990, wrote that the federal and legislative branches of the U.S. government are so corrupt that reform requires insurrection. James Madison argued in 1791, when he introduced the Bill of Rights to the Constitution as its first 10 amendments, that the people, not the government, possesses the absolute sovereignty. Abraham Lincoln said that if the people retain their virtue and vigilance, no administration, by any extreme of wickedness or folly, can very seriously injure the governmental concepts of our founding ancestors. If we wish to take hope and some encouragement in the long struggle ahead to right the balance of power in this country, perhaps it is not too late to agree with James Boyle, who wrote in the New York Times, "One reason we have a democracy is because people make unspeakably stupid decisions without it." And that was something I wrote, "An Assumption of Freedom." And now, being that this is a 4th of July weekend being celebrated coming up, even though the 4th is a few days away, I'd like to read a Declaration of Economic Independence. And it was by the People's Bicentennial Commission of 1976. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the economic bonds which have tied them to another, a decent respect for the opinions of humankind requires that they should declare the cause which impel them to separation, the causes. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, economic institutions are instituted among the people, deriving their just power from the consent of the citizens, that whenever any economic system becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new economic system, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that economic systems long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that people are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such economic institutions and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient suffering of the American people, and such is now the necessity which compels us to alter our former economic system. The history of the present giant corporations is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let the facts be submitted to a candid world. America's giant corporations have seized control over the great land and resources of our country. They have systematically destroyed thousands of small businesses and forced millions of Americans to become wage serfs for the wealthy owners. They have formed shared monopolies in virtually every major retail and wholesale industry, forcing millions of consumers to pay higher and higher prices for goods and services they cannot do without, these monopoly practices being the primary cause of runaway inflation. They have forced millions of Americans into unemployment by systematically closing down their American plants and moving their business operations abroad so they can hire cheaper labor and reap still greater profits for their owners. In the name of profit, they have expropriated billions of dollars of wealth produced by the working men and women of this country. The giant corporations have, pursued a policy of industrial negligence which kills 14,000 workers and permanently disables 900,000 more every year. They have manufactured unsafe products that kill 30,000 and permanently disable 110,000 Americans each year. They have used the energy crisis in order to double the price of fuel and make record gains in profit. They have turned our nation into a weapons factory, wasting valuable labor and resources that could be utilized for basic human needs. They have fostered tensions and conflicts between races, sexes, and ethnic groups in their arbitrary and discriminatory employment practices. They have pillaged the resources, exploited the peoples, and systematically intervened in the domestic affairs of other nations in order to profit their corporate treasures. The giant corporations have subverted the Constitution of the United States and the principle of government of, by, and for the people by illegally financing their own candidates for local, state, and national office, by placing their own supporters in key government commissions and regulatory agencies, by using massive lobbying operations to virtually dictate the legislative direction of the state and federal governments, including the decisions on how our tax money is to be allocated. It is these same corporate giants that profess the strongest attachments to self-reliance while pocketing billions of dollars of our tax money in the form of government subsidies and special favors, that profess their commitment to preserving their country's future while systematically destroying our natural environment, that herald the virtues of personal responsibility and accountability while engaging in wholesale crime under the protection of their corporate charters. America's giant corporations have issued a death sentence against the individual human spirit by forcing millions of Americans to perform mindless functions 8 hours per day inside the corporate machine, by rewarding obedience, conformity, and dependency, and penalizing creative thinking, criticism, and independent judgment. The corporate giants have violated our sacred rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness by denying us adequate access to the means to sustain life, by severely limiting our opportunities to choose the kind of work life we would like to lead, by denying Americans a range of work choices that are potentially self-fulfilling and rewarding. The corporations have created and perpetuated a small hereditary aristocracy with wealth and power unrivaled in the annals of recorded history. The corporate system has proved itself to be grossly inefficient and wasteful, while the corporate owners and managers have proven themselves to be incompetent to make prudent decisions that affect the economic well-being of the American people. In their obsession with profits, their lust for the absolute dominion over the life of this nation, and their total disregard for the American people, corporate owners and managers have plunged our country into a state of economic chaos, destroyed the lives of millions of families, and threatened the very survival of the republic. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. An economic system whose character is thus marked by every act which may define an absolute tyranny is unfit to claim the loyalty and allegiance of a free and democratic people. We, therefore, the citizens of the United States of America, hereby call for the abolition of these giant institutions of tyranny and the establishment of new economic enterprises with new laws and safeguards to provide for the equal and democratic participation of all American citizens in the economic decisions that affect the well-being of our families, our communities, and our nation. In furtherance of our joint hopes and aspirations, and mindful of the lesson of history, we steadfastly adhere to the general principle that a democratic republic can only exist to the extent that economic decision-making power is broadly exercised by the people and not delegated to a few. Such is the necessity which compels us to act in support of decentralized economic enterprises, with ownership and control shared jointly by the workers and by the local communities in which they operate, with similar patterns of shared representative control being exercised on a regional and national level to ensure the smooth and efficient coordination of all economic operations. For the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. and that was the Declaration of Economic Independence by the People's Bicentennial Commission of 1976. And now I'd like to read again something I wrote, which I generally read around this time every year. And I say the disclaimer still holds. Flags passing by. Whenever an American flag is unfurled, I feel that I am a stranger instead of a citizen. I don't dislike the flag. I just feel that flag wavers and I live in separate countries. Flags are everywhere. In public places, of course, but they bloom also from houses, offices, automobiles, stenciled on T-shirts and worn as lapel pins. These persistent and nagging proclamations of Americanhood, which might seem reasonable though rude in a foreign country, seem discriminatory and shabbily neurotic here at home. I am sure that most people who feel a compulsion to mark themselves with a flag believe in freedom and democracy for themselves and those they regard as like themselves, but I doubt they feel the same passion about the rights and liberties of others who practice a different religion, or none, or who have a different skin color, or are recent immigrants. The flag conceals more than it illuminates. Its red stripes represent the blood shed by the early patriots who, if one needs to be reminded, were traitors. The stars are symbols of conquest, the brutal displacement of one civilization by another. Some of our citizens veil themselves with flags, merging self-perceived inadequacies with the civic inequities and empirical ambitions disguised by fervent nationalism. Underneath the patriotic bunting can be sensed the grim frenzy and unforgiving intolerance for new ideas and those who engage in them. The pledge allegiance to the flag that children must say every day in public schools, which contains the phrase, "One nation under God," is the national school prayer. A flag is, after all, a tribal totem, relatively unsophisticated in an expanding global civilization in which such iconoclastic relics of humanity's immaturity should be displayed in museums. Yet people still do get upset when someone trods upon a flag or blows a nose on its stars and stripes. Making shirts of flags or burning them in public protest gives police and some military veterans, not all, apoplexy. Patriots, poor confused souls who think their personal lives would improve if the USA dominated the earth, roar with anger and anguish because desecrating the flag is protected by the Constitution's guarantee of free speech and is in character with the precepts of democracy. A piece of cloth, whatever its mythological imperative, is not to be placed above human rights. What is freedom worth if in dissent against its loss, its symbols cannot be dramatically abused? Symbols are powerful. They define purpose, hold people together, but separate them also. Humanity is cross-breeding at an incredible rate. Primitive icons of separateness are increasingly meaningless. Our species will truly be free when it is able to abandon the symbols that perpetuate its divisions. The many tribes no longer need their special banners and bunting, except as family talismans put away for memory. I do not participate in flag ceremonies or attend parades in which legions of flags are marched past me. For a few years, I was obliged to salute the flag twice a day during its raising and lowering, and when I was at war for the flag, I dreaded it would swaddle my corpse. I would not spit on the flag because I don't think a flag is that important. Why should anyone care if someone burns a flag or makes love on one? And that is something I wrote, and which I generally read annually at this time of year, Flags Passing By. And I do wish you a happy 4th of July, whether it is on the 2nd of July or on the 4th. And I will probably be back on Bloody Thursday, July 5th, if, of course, the sky doesn't fall on me, or a truck run me down, or I fall into the river and find myself dog paddling outside the bar. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.